Okay, good morning. I think we could start. My name is Olga Nyberger. I'm Director, Office of Sponsored Research, Grants and Agreements. So the purpose of today's info session is really to look over tri-agency open access policy. As you know, like it's new policy, which is in implementation from May 1st, so raised a lot of questions and really, the purpose we would like objectives really to go through this and to demystify and to tell that it's not really difficult to comply with this policy, but certainly specific knowledge is required how to handle and those compliance. So actually, the main speaker or its really presentation for today, it would be done by Jen Rally, Associate Dean Digital Initiatives. So just to explain you, to answer questions about what type of resources available to help you and other McGill researchers to comply with open access policy. I will just to mention that at the end of the session, I mean after the session, we will send you survey questionnaire, please answer those questions. It will help us to build future sessions. As well, I would like to mention that a presentation by Jen will be recorded and posted on our website because there are a lot of researchers or administrators who contacted us and they would like to attend today's session, but unfortunately not available. So this link will be provided to you as well to other McGill researchers and administrators. And also, so I will not take a long time, but I wanted just to introduce that the concept of open access policy, it's really, I like more concept that we're talking about open science. This is actually very nice definition was done by National Science Foundation that public access is intended to accelerate the dissemination of fundamental research results that will advance the frontiers of knowledge and help ensure that nation's future prosperity. So I would prefer to keep in mind open science context versus of policy when it's like it's policing something. Okay, so just very quickly, certainly open science, we see more benefits to researchers. So this allowed immediate and free access to articles, increased visibility across discipline, especially now when we're talking about interdisciplinarity and collaborations, increased frontier of discovery. Also leverage new impact measures as alternative metrics and certainly speeds dissemination of discoveries and results. As well, the whole in mind really with open science and open access, it's really benefits for other stakeholders. As for institutions, certainly it would be get a complete picture of research output, as well increased impact and exposure. For funding agency, also increased visibility. As you know, they very often also question and what it's exactly they're doing and why they invest their funds in certain type of research. And also for government and industry, it's really advantage, it's hoping that it's really speed innovation and increase competitiveness as our enterprises as well research institutes. And certainly for citizens, the citizens will be more informed and as consequences more engaged in research and innovation aspects. This is, I guess all of you know already this website where you could read, and please I invite you read and also questions and answer, very nice presented on government website. Certainly the main policy statement, it's really that all tri-agency supported research should be freely accessible within 12 months of publications. And as you know, they indicate really two routes. It's online repository, which we call green route, which is no cost would be from your side, I mean from the side of the author. And the second route, it's gold route, when it's required publication is journals. Here you might incur some costs, but it's again overall those costs eligible to build in your application, in your budget. So those two routes, it's again what is important, they are not mutually exclusive, so you could really apply both, in both directions. And how to apply and what resources available, certainly our presenters will share with you in details informations. To conclude my introduction, I would like to bring to your attention this absolutely very important to enable open access compliance through the whole life cycle of your grants. Not thinking, okay, I'm just getting grant right now, and in 5 years, by the end, I will just really to need and to see how I disseminate. Because it's really steps during grant life cycle, it's very important, even from the beginning when you identify projects, to create early awareness. So in this time, you will be able to develop effective processes, workflow, and et cetera. The system, how you will keep your data, how you will materials, how you collaborate with your collaborators. So it's really to help you to establish effective and processes and workflow information, which would be helpful and facilitate your compliances with reporting, publications, and et cetera. It's again, it's very helpful for your next applications, because when you link already results or publications from grants providers in the previous competitions, it's really increased your competitiveness. So this is really, I'm inviting you start to talk with our grants officers when you, at the time of developing your proposal, during implementation. And so we could help you and answer your question and link you whenever it's necessary to additional information. So this is our Office of Sponsor Research contacts. This is the name of grants officers. So you will please free to contact them when you even to start to think about your grants applications during the period of your projects, and certainly at the end when you finalize and wrapping up and thinking about the next application. Thank you for your attention, and now I'm inviting our speakers, Jen, who will share with you what type of resources would be available and how it would be useful for you. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jen Riley, as Olga said. Thank you so much for the introduction and to get us started today. I think this is a really important topic. The libraries are me and the people in my department and our subject liaisons, which are assigned to your units, your departments, and your faculties to help you, are all working very hard to get ready to help you comply with this policy, to get some more information resources out there, and to make sure we're aware of all the right journals and all the right repositories in your discipline so that we can assist you. So I'm going to spend just a few minutes delving a little more deeply into the policy than we were able to in the introduction just a moment ago. So the policy itself applies only to peer-reviewed journal publications. It does not apply to conference proceedings. It does not apply to more newsletter types of things that aren't peer-reviewed. Only peer-reviewed journal publications are within scope of the policy for now. It applies to all three agencies, which is new. Some of you may be aware CIHR has had a pre-existing policy, but the new harmonized policy is the same across all three granting agencies for publications, so we'll get to this in just a minute. It applies to all awards that have start dates after May 1st, 2015, so very recently. They announced this pretty quickly, so if you have an award starting soon, it may be based on a proposal that you put in before this policy was announced. So we've got a little bit of a period where you didn't have as much planning as you might have hoped, but now that the policy is in place, any grants that you're planning for the future will take this into account, for example, in your grant budget when you're thinking about whether to fund publication charges. And for those, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good question. I suspect the Quebec agencies will be further behind. I suspect they're going to be a little slow here. One of the issues we'll get to much later is that one of the ways in which the tri-agencies want to support compliance with this policy is funding article processing charges. So if there's an open access journal that charges a fee to publish to open access, they want you to be able to cover that from your grant funds. With the smaller amounts in the Quebec funding agencies, that seems less possible, so they might have a little bit of a harder time making that decision. I think in the UK and in the US, we're seeing more and more funding agencies sign on to these things after the big major federal ones have. So it is trickling down, but it's certainly not going to be immediate, I think. So for these publications, these peer-reviewed journal articles that arise out of one of the three tri-agency grants, you have to make them publicly available within 12 months of first publication. So there's a possibility of an embargo period here, and a lot of publishers do allow you, certainly, to deposit your work into a repository and make it available only after an embargo period has passed. So the tri-agencies have put a possible embargo period into their policy in order to help publishers who have business models based on subscriptions to journals, for example. So for SHRC and NSERC, this is brand new. There was never an open access requirement for publications before in either of those areas. However, the new harmonized policy is modeled after a pre-existing CIHR policy. So if you work in the health sciences fields, you may be aware that every grant awarded from CIHR since 2008 has been required to do very similar things. And the CIHR policy was used as a model for the new harmonized policy. There's still one bit of a difference between CIHR and the other agencies, that the CIHR has also long had an open access to data clause in their policy, and that continues. So we'll get to this in a little while about the details, but they ask that data in certain disciplines, genomics, molecular coordinate data, things like that, get shared in appropriate repositories and get kept for 5 years after the end of the grant. So I'll get into the details of that later, but I want you to know if you're in the health sciences field, that has not changed. That's still a requirement from CIHR. At the moment, there is no requirement for sharing of raw data for SHRC and NSERC grants, and I'll speak in a little while about that. That might change in the fairly near future. Okay, so the tri-agencies, the screenshot we saw earlier of the policy itself is pretty short. It's basically what I just showed you. The policy page spends a lot of time discussing why they did this, because that's a question they've got, certainly. They articulate a set of principles that they used in developing the details of the policy, and they come out and say, first and foremost, that they respect the principle of academic freedom and that they want their researchers to be able to publish and that they think this is a right. And they've found what they believe is a good balance between the value of opening up access to research and the researcher's right to publish where they choose. So we'll talk a little bit later about how that plays out in practice, but they want to come out and say that first and foremost, they believe in these things and they believe the policy is consistent with these things. Second, because the policy only applies to peer-reviewed research, they made that decision because they recognize the importance of peer review to how scholarship works. So they want to underscore that that's a valued part of the scholarly communications ecosystem that will continue to be a part. So they want that peer-reviewed research to be the stuff that really gets out there for other people to be able to read. The next couple bullets they use in their explanation are all about the value of openness to the scholarly community, that openly sharing of research contributes to better quality research, that open sharing of research contributes to recognized research best practices across disciplines, and a culture of sharing promotes good research. And that, as we heard in the introduction a little while ago, that fundamentally pushing science forward, pushing knowledge forward, pushing research forward is done better when anybody can view the research that other people have done, and it's more effectively disseminated. And they finally note that this is new to Canada, but it's not new in the world of scholarship. Major research funding agencies in all sorts of disciplines in both the U.S. and the U.K. and elsewhere in the world have had these very similar policies in place for up to 10 years now in the case of the National Institutes of Health in the United States. So it's the work being done by the tri-agencies now is aligning Canada with what's going on elsewhere in the English-speaking world, at least. So there are lots of questions about why this is happening, though. So the tri-agencies did issue a public consultation at the end of 2013, gathering information from researchers, publishers, grants administrators on, you know, is this a good idea? How should we implement this? What should the policy look like? They received a large number of responses, and predictably, they were all over the map. There's a really great summary of the responses online if you're interested and want to go find it. I think it's on the SHRC website. There are very different opinions about the appropriate length of an embargo period. Should all research be made available immediately, after 6 months, after 12 months, after 18 months? 12 is what they chose in the end. That's consistent with U.S. and U.K. policies, though a lot of the U.K. policies, for example, from the Wellcome Trust are shorter with a six-month embargo. But the tri-agencies made it really clear with this implementation that it's their job with public funds to make the research that you are doing available to the widest possible audience as soon as possible. And open access is the way to do that. And they're being consistent with federal mandates as well. The Canadian federal government has issued several reports about open data, open government, open science in the last few years. And the one I've linked here explicitly has a section on open science that says we need to find a way to make research done with public funds available to everyone in the world to read. So, as we heard earlier, there are two routes to complying with this policy, and it's pretty simple. The first route that, from my conversations so far, seems to be what most researchers prefer is publishing your journal article wherever you see feel is appropriate, in the best journal in your field, where it belongs, but then depositing a copy of your manuscript in an online open access repository. And I'll talk in much more detail about this in just a minute. The second route, that's called the green open access, if you want to use those terms. The second route is publishing in a journal that itself is open access. Some of these have fully open access, all the papers in that journal are open access. Others have the ability to pay a little extra and get your paper to be open access when the rest are not. So we'll talk about both of these in much greater detail starting right now. So if you want to take the first route, the publish wherever you want, then deposit your article somewhere, the green route, you can choose either a disciplinary repository, one that's well known in your field and is a place where you and your colleagues would go to look for papers, or you can choose to do that in an institutional repository, one we host here at McGill. We do have an institutional repository at McGill. It's run out of the library. It's called eScholarship. And what we do with that is you email us with information about your publication, and we'll work with you to get it in. And we will also manage any necessary embargo periods. If your publisher is requiring an embargo period, we will get the article in, keep it safe, and automatically open access to it when the embargo period expires. Absolutely. Was there another question? I'm sorry. Yep. Okay. Yes, we'll absolutely share these slides afterwards, and I understand there's a recording as well. All right. So we're here to help you for eScholarship at McGill. All you have to do is send an email. We'll have to work with you on which version of the paper to deposit. There might be a little bit of conversation, but we can help you do that. However, you may prefer to deposit your work in a disciplinary repository, again, the sort of place that you and your colleagues would naturally go to look for one of these things. If you'd like to find one, your subject liaison in the library can help you, or you can look at this Directory of Open Access Repositories, which I'll click on that link in just a moment, and we can take a look at it. But in general, I think if there's a really strong one in your field, you probably already know about it. These are the places you're already going. For CAHR grantees, PubMed Central Canada is the place to go. Some of you may be aware it was down for a significant period of time after a hacking event. It is now back up as of this week, which is great. And unfortunately, it's only available for CAHR grantees to deposit in, but it is really intended to be the place for Canadian health research to be open access. If you're in computer science, high energy physics, one of those fields, you'll know about Archive. It's one of the longest standing disciplinary repository and is absolutely fundamental to the work in most of those fields. If you're in one of the social sciences fields, you may be familiar with the Social Science Research Network, where lots of papers from different disciplines related to social sciences are placed. But there are many, many, many more. And let's see. We'll go to this directory here just to take a look at it. We can search for repositories. All right, so they have a classification into subject area where you can, you know, type a search term and then limit to a subject area. But let's just see what happens if we type bioinformatics. Did I spell that properly? Okay, so when I search for bioinformatics, I get 4 results. I can see there's one out of the Genome Informatics Lab at Indiana University, and another one that seems to be related to that, one in the UK, and the Protein Data Bank. So the idea is you can do some searches here, and then you can explore in more detail. So if we want to see the Protein Data Bank, hopefully that takes us all the way to the repository, but there's more information here. All right, so it gives you information about where to find it, what sorts of subject it covers, whether it covers publications or data sets. So this directory of repositories is for repositories that handle both data and papers. So if you're looking for a place to deposit your paper, the Protein Data Bank's not the place to go. If you're looking for a place to deposit your data, it looks like the Protein Data Bank may be a place to go. So you need to read the descriptions and follow up a little to see if it's right for you. And yeah, the library can absolutely help you with all of this. And our subject liaisons are definitely going to be familiar with the best repositories in your field and can assist with that. All right. So there's a little bit of a trick when taking this deposit route. And that is that the tri-agencies require that the final peer-reviewed manuscript be the one that's deposited. So this is the version of, a version of your paper following the peer review process and following the corrections you've made to that. Some publishers would prefer that you deposit only the version you sent to them in the first place for review instead of the version after peer review. But the policy requires it is the version after peer review. So you'll need to make sure that you can do that. And we'll talk about negotiating with publishers a little later. The good news is that based on the best available data I've seen, approximately 70% of publishers have default policies across all or most of their journals that do allow you to deposit what we call the postprint, the version after peer review. Not necessarily the publisher's PDF after they've done all the layout and put it into 2 columns and all that stuff, but at least the version that is the absolutely final corrected version with all the tables and all the peer review comments incorporated. So that's a detail to be aware of. In many cases, no. So we'll definitely talk about that in just a moment, how to learn about which version you can submit. And it gets a little tricky once you get into that. Okay, so because you have to put in a specific version, at least the postprint or the publisher's PDF, you're going to need to figure out if the publisher you're publishing with has a policy that allows you to do that. And if it doesn't, you may need to negotiate with them to tell them that you're required to do this and adjust your publishing agreement so that that's allowed. And this is the researcher's responsibility. The tri-agencies have said, this is the policy you're expected to comply, so it is your job to make sure that whatever agreement you sign with the publisher allows you to do this. So if you've read your publishing agreements in the past, you'll know that what typically happens in most cases is that the publisher asks you to transfer the copyright to the article from you, the author, to them, the publisher. That's the vast majority of cases that happens, and all the major commercial publishers, that's what happens. So when you do that, you no longer control your work. You no longer have the right to disseminate it. It's their copyright. They have those rights. So you have to read your publishing agreement very carefully to understand what rights you're transferring to them and what rights you're keeping. And those publishing agreements typically say you can put it on your website or you can't put it on your website. You can put it into your institutional repository or you can't. So you need to look into the details. Luckily, most journal websites have a PDF or a web page of their policies for that journal that you can go read before you submit. Or there's a really handy database out of JISC in the UK called Sherpa Romeo, and I love to get my. Oh, there it is. Where's my? There it is. There's a great database called Sherpa Romeo that helps you do this. So, does anybody have a journal they want to look up that they're curious what their policy is? Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that. Psychoneuro. Next word. And oh gosh, and I can't spell because you guys are watching me type. Chronology. You know what I think? Let's say starts with, and that's probably enough. How's that? I don't know how to spell. All right, we are searching. There we go. Okay. So we type it, we find it. Okay. So this database, it's certainly not comprehensive. Of course, you can't expect any database to have every journal everywhere, but it is pretty darn good. The times I've needed something that has not been in there have been very few and far between, especially for English language journals. So we'll ignore the stuff at the beginning for now. What you want to look at, so it says the author can archive the preprint, pre-refereeing. That's nice, but it doesn't help us because, remember, the tri-agency policy is after peer review. Then it says green check. The author can archive the post-print, final draft, post-refereeing. Great. Seems like it's compliant. We're going to read the small print here in just a minute just to make sure, but that's what we're going to do. This is very typical. And it says the author cannot archive the publisher's version PDF, to answer your question from earlier. That is very typical as well. It's very few publishers that do allow you to archive the publisher's PDF. Most are exactly like this. They allow you the post-referee, but not the publisher's PDF. So Sherpa Romeo uses a color coding system. So you see at the top it says this is a Romeo green journal. Journals that are either green or blue in Sherpa Romeo comply with the tri-agency open access policy, providing you read the fine print. If it's white or yellow, it probably doesn't or it may not. You'll have to look a little further. So what we can do is we need to read the general conditions. We need to look into the details. So you can put your preprint on any website, blah, blah, blah. You can put the post-print on your personal website immediately. You can put the post-print on an open access repository like eScholarship or PubMed Central Canada after embargo period of between 12 and 48 months. I'm not sure exactly what between means in this case. It's something you may have to go directly to the publisher to read. But the 12-month embargo is consistent with the tri-agency policy. So if you wanted to deposit an e-scholarship, you'd give us the post-print, the version. It's a Word document, probably, post-peer review. We would set it to a 12-month embargo period. We'd go ahead and put it in the repository, and then we would make it available after 12 months on the right day. So you're compliant with the granting agency requirements and you're compliant with the journal's publishing agreements. You should be all set. And I'll say the vast, vast majority of journals I've looked up in situations like this since this policy was announced have been exactly like this. They're green, you can deposit the post-print but not the publisher's PDF, and you get an embargo period that's probably around 12 months. This is very, very typical. I'll note that this journal also offers a paid open access option, which we'll talk about in just a minute as the other route to meeting the agency's policy. Is there another one somebody wants to look up? Molecular therapy. Okay. The first time I did this, somebody wanted to look up Science and Nature, and the good news is they're both compliant as well. All right, molecular therapy. It's probably this first one, I assume, from, okay? All right, so let's see. Just because it's yellow doesn't mean it's bad. We're going to read the fine print. Okay. So, author can archive preprint. Great, doesn't help us. Subject to restrictions, you can archive the postprint. All right, this is promising. Let's see what it says. Okay. General conditions, authors retain copyright. That's great. That's unusual. It's fantastic. Published source must be acknowledged and DOI cited. Okay. Must link to publisher version. Publisher's PDF cannot be used. Okay. General conditions, on author's personal website and institutional repository. Now, for this, that's a little, does that mean yes on author's website? I think that's what it means. Okay, if funding, oh, here we go, yes, the next one. If funding agency rules apply, that's our case, authors may post author's version to the relevant funding body's archive, PubMed Central Canada, 6 months after publication. All right, so we're all set. So just because it's yellow doesn't mean it's bad, it just means you have to read the fine print. So again, this is pretty typical. Yes. Yeah, so I know that's the case with PubMed Central in the U.S. and the NIH, and I think that's the case for some Canadian, to do for Canadian grant agencies as well. Yes. Yeah, I think this is not going to go so well. I have a musicology degree, so. You can archive the preprint. You can even put the publisher's PDF in there. There may be, sometimes when you see that, there's an embargo period in the details. But, yeah, hey, that's great news. Come put an e-scholarship. All right. So this database is your friend. And the library is working on something that's going to make this a little easier for you to use that I'll tell you about in a little while at the end of the presentation. Okay. So if after that process... So after that process, you're probably going to find you're okay. Or maybe there's some details. Maybe you need to worry about the embargo period, but you're probably in good shape. If you do need to negotiate with your publisher, if the place you want to publish, I would also suggest doing this lookup before you submit your paper so that you know what you're getting into. But at the time when they've accepted your paper, you've done the peer review, and you're about to sign that publishing agreement, if you need to make a change to it because you're required to comply with certain things by the tri-agencies, you can and should negotiate those rights with the publisher. One way to do that is by a standard author addendum that we have on the library's website. And this came out of a North American Scholarly Communication Open Access coalition called SPARC, and it was also, it was tweaked for Canadian use by the Canadian Association of Research Libraries. So it's basically just a PDF. You fill in your details and the journal name, and it says, okay, despite what my publishing agreement says, I retain the right to post in my institutional repository, use in my teaching and research, and it allows you to keep some rights that are really fundamental to you doing your job and using your work in ways you need to. And it basically asks the publisher to sign it and send it back to you. There's also an interesting clause in the agreement that says if the publisher doesn't sign it and send it back to you, but publishes your paper anyways, that's okay. The agreement is still valid. So it's done a little legal trickery there. Now, nobody's sued anybody over this. But, you know, you should talk to your editors. You know, and the thing is, your editors are your colleagues, right? They're facing these same publisher. They're facing these same funding agency policies. The publishers themselves are obviously, for obvious reasons, a little more hesitant to this, but your editor is probably used to working with them. So that's one way to negotiate your rights, and we'll get back to this in a little later about how you might do that. Okay, so that's the green road. That's the publish wherever you want, deposit in a repository, either disciplinary or institutional. The other option for meeting the policy is publishing in an open access journal in the first place. Many open access journals are funded through societies or institutions and can cover their charges through their base budgets. Others, especially lots from commercial publishers, push those charges to authors. And these are called APCs, or article processing charges. They tend to be between, say, $1,000 and $5,000, with the average being around $3,000. That's more common in, say, the biomedical fields than it is in other areas. $3,000. That's typical. So for humanities researchers, their grants tend to be much smaller. It would be unusual for there to be an article processing charge in your field for music. You know, in health sciences, it's very common, probably not a lot in music. So when you do this, some journals will publish closed access first, only available to people with library subscriptions, and then make an article available after 6 or 12 months. That's okay. That complies with the policy as long as it's within 12 months. It's okay if the journal is hybrid. So this is a term we use in the scholarly communications world to use a journal that is a traditional subscription journal. The McGill Library licenses every year, pays so much money to the publisher for access for you. But in addition to that subscription, the author can pay an additional fee, probably $3,000, to have their article made open access from day one. That also meets the tri-agency requirement. We don't love this model in the library because we're already paying $16 million a year for collections, and now we're paying $3,000 an article on top of that. We're not sure that's the right way for the future, but it meets the tri-agency policy. So, there are some. These are really good questions. So there's some data out there. I probably couldn't pull it up right away, but some data is showing journals that have a hybrid model promising to reduce their subscription fees based on how much they actually end up earning from the open access queue. And then there's some data that shows that some of them are actually reducing their subscription costs, not by a lot and not many of them, but it's happening in some fields. You know, our gut reaction in the library tends to be that if we move from a subscription model to an author pays model, that that's going to end up costing as much, if not more, in the future. That's kind of our gut reaction. There's actually some studies going on right now that say that may not be true. I'm hesitant to really accept them, but they're just getting started. You know, and even if it doesn't cost more, the ethical question of, well, if we have a problem with only people with money can read, then why would we be okay with only people with money can publish? You know, so there's some big, big fundamental questions here that are unanswered at the moment. But to go back to your first point, which I think is a really important one and is the last point on this slide, I think, you know, it is easy to assume that open access journals are lower quality, and I will just say that is not true across the board, right, that we should take our, you know, scholarly critical apparatuses and apply them to journals, right? Look at who's publishing in them, read the papers, see if they're actually quality, look who's on the editorial board. There are lots of good open access journals out there. There are lots of terrible subscription journals out there. So yes, the newer ones, of course, haven't built their reputation up yet. And some of them are predatory, and some of them are people just trying to, you know, get money from author's fees. So we shouldn't publish in those, obviously. So we need to just be really critical and understand where the good places to publish are. And that's something the library, your librarian, can absolutely help you with. Does that help? So if you want to find an open access journal, if that's something you're just interested in, you can go to the directory of open access journals. All right, I want to search. I want to take articles off. Does anybody have a subject area they want me to look for? Oh, what is that?
Demography.
Okay. So we've got 198 journals that come up. Now, so, you know, some of them come from, say, Czechoslovakia. So, you know, I don't want to make assumptions about research from Czechoslovakia, but this might be something you would want to look into. You know, so this is just a starting point, right? Don't just pick the first one off here and submit your journal. Look into it. You know, see if there are colleagues you respect that have published there or on the editorial board, and look into it from there. So, you know, this is a pretty big database. This database has recently committed to redoing their criteria for inclusion. So every journal that's included here has been asked to resubmit itself for inclusion based on more strict criteria. So this is just getting better and better over time. And of course, there's things you can do here, like limit to, I don't know how this works. Oh, yeah, limit to only article, only journals that don't require article processing charges, or limit to journals that do. You can see where it's published out of if you care about that. So there's some good features here to help you figure out whether or not the journals you're looking at are places you want to be publishing. Okay. So again, you know, you would not submit your paper to a print journal you've never heard of either, right? Do your due diligence. Make sure the place you're submitting to is a place you really want your work to be represented in. Okay, so we've covered the main aspects of the policy. Let me dig a little into just a few other details. We heard this in the introduction. The TAR agencies encourage you to, even though you can take just one or the other route, the deposit route or the open access publishing route, they actually encourage you to take both. If you do publish your journal, if you do publish your article open access, that doesn't keep you from depositing that journal into a repository for preservation purposes. They encourage you to do that, and we're happy to do that in e-scholarship, and most of your disciplinary repositories are probably happy to take them as well. So you can and should think about doing both. They have standard conditions about recognizing the funding agency and putting your grant number on all publications, including the post-print you put into the repository, so that Word document you're going to give to us to put into e-scholarship, we should definitely have the grant number on there. They make really clear that putting your article on your personal website is not sufficient. That does not meet the requirements of the repository, of the policy. It has to be a managed repository, either for your discipline or for your institution. They have not come out and said for sure whether systems like academia.edu, ResearchGate, or Figshare meet the requirements of the policy. We're assuming for the time being, in the absence of an answer, that they don't, that you need to go to a repository for your discipline or your institution. I hope they're going to clarify that soon, but many people have asked that question, and I haven't seen a good answer. It only applies to research funds. So especially for say, SHRC, there are, and the folks in Sponsored Research will know this more than me, but there are programs just for training and salary awards. And those programs, the policy doesn't apply to, but they do apply to research funds that, say, hire a postdoc and pay the postdoc salary out of it. So it's a little tricky there, and I think Sponsored Research will help you navigate that, and perhaps asking your contact at the agency will help clear that up. It's just a little tricky. Now, I promised earlier to talk more about research data. So the policy does include one clause related to research data, and it keeps CIHR's pre-existing data policy in play. So any bioinformatics, atomics, or molecular coordinate data has to be deposited in what they call the appropriate public database. This is GenBank. They tell you what these places are, and if you work in these fields, you already know what these places are. These are the standard places to go. CIHR also requires you to keep data sets around for 5 years. The library is working on ways to help you do that. In the meantime, if you want some help, just contact us. We can talk. At the moment, there is no requirement for SHRC or NSERC recipients to make their research data fundamentally or openly available. At the same time the tri-agencies issued the consultation for the open access policy on publications, they issued a separate consultation on open data. They got more responses to that, and they were even wider ranging than the ones they got on publications. What they've done is they have a draft that should be made public sometime, who knows, it could be 6 months, on principles for good data management. So what we expect to happen is for them not to issue a whole policy, the way we have for publications, but what we expect is a document from them that says you should do some data management planning, which means before you apply for your grant, you should sit down and think about what data you're going to create, what formats it's going to be in, how you're going to create metadata that allows that data to be useful in the future, and whether or not you can share it. We do not expect the policy to say all data has to be shared, because there are very real, for example, ethical human subject issues that say we can't share this data. Obviously, they understand that. So I think what we expect is a document that gives some guidance for good practices and helps you think through the process of whether you can make your data available and how to create that data so that it has a longer lifespan. So we should expect that soon. I've seen a draft of what they have, and it's pretty good. I, again, don't know how long it's going to be before that actually becomes something they send out. Okay. So the next question most people tend to have is enforcement. How do they know I do this? In their FAQ, what they say is this is an issue like any other research compliance issue. This is the same as if you use the money for the things you say you're going to use it for and don't go on a trip to the Bahamas, for example. It's just like that. There's an investigative process and all that sorts of stuff. So it looks like, for the time being, they're not kind of having a program officer check off every grant. But, of course, the same way we have to, submit budgets and the same way we have to write grant reports, we are responsible for doing these things and complying. CAHR does have a way to monitor this, though, through their pre-existing research reporting system. And there's, I've never been on a CAHR grant. I've only been in Canada for about a year and a half. But I understand the research reporting system has a place where you list the bibliographic information for all the papers, and there's a field for a DOI or a URL, and it's not going to let you leave it blank, that you have to show that you've made this thing publicly available. All right. A lot of people hear about this and become concerned that it is going to limit their publishing options. Because of that 70% number I was saying earlier that most journals really actually do have policies that let you comply, I think once you start looking into this, you find that you probably do have more choice than you might have feared. This really does not have to restrict your publishing options. The majority of journals already have policies that are consistent with the expectations of the tri-agencies, and you absolutely can negotiate your publishing agreement with these journals. Now, I know publishing myself, you can feel powerless in talking with journals. I just need to get my research out there. I've got to get tenure. I've got to get this published. But if you step back and look at it, this publisher needs your article. They accepted your article because it's better than the other stuff they had. They want to keep their reputation up. They don't want to give up on all that effort they put into managing the peer review process and have you pull out at the last minute. And they know this is coming. This is not new from Canada. This has been happening from institutional open access mandates and from federal mandates in the US and the UK for a number of years now. If you go to them and you say, I have a funding agency mandate that requires open access within 12 months, they may huff and puff a little, but they know what's coming and it's not a surprise. So you can do it. We can help in the library. I'll give you a little more information on the resources we have available. And there are, again, more and more open access options for journals out there. I think I forgot to say out loud earlier that if you have article processing charges, if you want to publish in an open access journal that does charge you that $3,000 fee, that is an allowable grant expense. You can put it into your grant budget. The tri-agencies will cover it. So when that's an option, absolutely. And that's what you want to do, and that's the journal you want to publish in. And more journals are offering that option. So that's a good way to comply and a good way to have it not limit your publishing options. Okay, so here's what we do in the library. I showed you that really cool Sherpa Romeo database earlier. It's not that hard to use, but you do have to read the details and you have to remember it and you have to find the link and all that stuff. What we're working on, or at least going to be working on soon, and we hope to have ready in the fall, is a little search box on the library website or on your subject guide for your discipline that you type in the journal name and it gives you a thumbs up or a thumbs down, just to make it easy. Again, you have to go read those fine print, and it'll link to the fine print, but we're trying to make it just one little step easier for you so that you can look up a journal. And we're trying to think about what other lists of compliant journals in your discipline sorts of things we might do. That's once you start trying to categorize journals by discipline, that gets hard quickly, but we're seeing what we can do in that area. We can provide help negotiating deposit rights. On our website right now, there's an email template you can use to send to a publisher saying, I have this requirement. Here's that Carl Spark author addendum that I'd like to modify my publishing agreement with. You don't even have to think and write the email yourself if you don't want to. We have a template on the website that you can use or adapt as you see fit. We can sit down with you and look at a publishing agreement. We can help you understand what the terms are and what you're signing away and whether or not you're retaining rights that allow you to meet the trade agency requirement or are retaining rights that allow you to use your work in the way you want to in the future. We can help you find a place to deposit. We can help you find a repository that's useful for your discipline. We can help get your work into eScholarship. And we can help you find a journal that is open access and does have some credibility behind it and is not predatory. We can help you, you know, navigate that complex world of all these new journals, which ones are actually up to snuff and which ones aren't. So my advice to you is to sit down and really read the policy. The policy itself is very brief. That page is short. Almost all of the factual information I've given to you today is from the policy, from its FAQ, or from what they call the toolbox, which is basically a set of links to helpful resources like Sherpa and Romeo, like the Directory of Open Access Journals, like the Directory of Open Access Repositories. So there's a lot of really good information on the tri-agency website. You know, the best practice, of course, is to take compliance seriously, to engage with the details of this policy, because the basic part is really simple. Peer-reviewed publications within 12 months, deposit or publish in an open access journal. You got to worry about which version. There are some details to be on top of and just to know and to make sure that you're signing agreements that allow you to comply. So there's some details to be on top of. And, you know, the best practice is to read your publishing agreements, know what you're signing, and we can help with that. Keep copies of your author manuscript, because that's what you're going to need to deposit, probably, in most cases, if that's what you're going to do. And that's a good thing to have around for the future, because that's the version you're going to be able to use if you can't use the publisher PDF. Do some work. Figure out what the best journals and repositories in your discipline are. Be ready to you know, publish in the right place or talk or recommend them to your colleagues or disrecommend them to your colleagues. Know what the reputable and non-reputable ones when someone asks you for assistance. And I'd say, you know, with my advocacy hat on, I'd say this is an opportunity to step back and look at the scholarly publishing system, to think about how this is working for you, for your discipline, and think about what it is you're signing and thinking about what you want your role to be. When you're serving on a promotion and tenure committee, right, this is your opportunity to look at the research for the research, you know, say, was this good research rather than was this published in a good journal? To turn the conversation around to be about the research itself rather than the reputation of some place you publish. So that's my advocacy hat. Okay, so we left lots of time for questions intentionally so that we can talk a little bit. I understand the presentation's being recorded, and I know the slides and a one-page handout summarizing the key points are going to be sent out to you after the program. So what can I answer for you? Okay, that's a good question. So, PubMed Central's only been back up for less than a week. So, you know, like their whole website, including who can submit and how to submit, has all been down for about 2 years, so or a year and a half. So, I have not had an opportunity to look into the gory details of what the submission system is like to see if we would have the right to do that. But that's a very good idea, and I'll absolutely look into it.
Okay.
No, I should write that down. I will definitely look into that as a service. We want to do this. We want to help. We want to help you comply with the policy. We know dealing with these details feels like a burden. you just want to publish. You just want to get it out. But I also think, let's say we're able to do that, but we're not able to do that for all repositories out there, right? So if we're not doing it for, the repository in music that Julie wants to use, I would still categorize the work to do that as just part of grant administration. You have to write grant reports. You have to manage budgets. You have to hire students. It's just part of the overhead of your work. So I think we want to get to the point where it's considered that. But if we can help, if there's something big we can bite off to do as a service for researchers that'll provide assistance, we're more than willing to look into it. So thank you for the suggestion.
So I had a question, sort of two thought questions. So if you're a shared researcher, you're planning to write a book, and you publish your book, and it's not a practice. And then you come up for your next grant, and they say, look, you didn't do any open access publishing. Is that going to hurt your chances? Or is the fact that you're in a discipline where books are the currency,
right,
is going to make it okay?
Of course, I don't have all that much insight as to what goes on in short grant review panels, but I would be shocked if someone held the fact that somebody didn't make something open access that wasn't subject to the policy against them. I would absolutely believe that somebody not complying with the policy, meaning if you had a journal article that was subject to it, they would say, do we really want to fund them? Maybe we should talk to them. But a monograph that's not subject to the policy, I would have a hard time believing that would. I haven't seen them say for sure if they're planning on changing their reporting requirements.
Yeah, I mean,
They haven't said for sure. My interpretation is I wouldn't assume it is, but we're trying to find out.
Okay, I mean, yeah, so do let us know.
Yeah, well,
it's a lot of people already know how.
Sure,
like,
sure.
Yeah.
But, it's not managed in such a way that we can be confident it's going to be around for the long term, which is the point of the policy. So that's why I'm saying I wouldn't assume.
Okay.
But we're trying to find out. Yes.
You're going to find whatever article citation to the database is.
Right.
Which will typically take you to the journal page.
Right.
How do you, for somebody looking for an article,
yep,
to read that?
Our stats for eScholarship, I've forgotten the percentage, but the huge majority of people coming to eScholarship find the articles through title searching in Google. It's totally accessible to Google. So what I certainly do as a researcher, when I'm using an abstracting and indexing database and I find a paper and I click the link and I find the library doesn't have a subscription, first I go to Google and I put in that journal, that article title, and I get to an open access version from there. So we've taken great pains to make sure that the stuff in eScholarship is accessible to Google, and it's in Google Scholar as well. Oh, there's a little bit of that that helps the Google results, basically. You can go to eScholarship and search, but I think not many people come to McGill and say, what's here, right? That they're using Google based on journal titles or following a citation, for example. Oh, that's a good question. Journals, publishers have long turn their eyes away with regards to faculty putting copies of their journal articles on their websites and stuff like that. That's happening all the time. People are violating their license agreements, making these things available. Every once in a while, you hear a big push by a publisher to do something. There was actually a push from Elsevier to to contact academia.edu to take out the publisher PDFs from there in the last year or so. So from time to time, you'll hear a big row about that. But, you know, when that happens, publishers find they get a lot of bad publicity and the researchers yell at them, so they actually don't want to do that, right? So the best thing I can say is don't violate your publishing agreement, right? That was an unethical thing to do, and even though it's your research, you've signed away your rights. Play within the system. Negotiate when you have to. Publish in places that allow you to do this, and keep within. So the publishers are not going to particularly take action to care whether you meet your grant requirements, but they might potentially take action to make sure you're not sharing a version that you shouldn't be, according to your agreement. Absolutely. Yeah, there's several layers to this. So, you know, the first layer that we've been doing with e-scholarship for years is systematic CV review. If you want all of your work to be open access, send us your CV and we'll do the legwork to figure out what you can put in from the publisher PDF, what you can't. That's one researcher at a time. The next step might be something like using the publicly available APIs where you can program against from things like Scopus or the Web of Science, where we can get technical alerts when new things are published by McGill faculty, and we can start to contact people. You can take a step farther and spend $150,000 or so a year to subscribe to a service like Pure from Elsevier, or there's a competing one that I've forgotten its name out of the UK, that does this kind of alerts, what's been published from your campus, to try to feed some sort of systematic what's published at McGill. Most institutions that have bit the bullet and really tried to get good at this, you know, exactly what's being published out of our institution, are implementing it through faculty annual reporting processes. So as faculty every year say, this is what I published, they're using different sorts of technology to harvest that data and then pull articles into a repository. The administrators love this, right? There's great data to be had there. Faculty are usually less enthusiastic. At most institutions where this has been implemented, there's a lot of questions about you're overseeing my work. This is going to lead to you have to publish 3 articles a year. You're not going to get tenure. So there's some concern about oversight there. That's a tricky political thing on campuses that have started to do this. So there's many levels towards that. We haven't been talking, that I've been involved with at McGill, about really systematically do this through faculty annual reporting. Right. Yeah, so that's another. We're still subscribing, but it's not being promoted that I know of. No, they're not. They're really not. Yeah. Well, you know what? It's voluntary. No, it's not required. Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and there's some big publishers out there that are providing a lot of this infrastructure, you know, for an appropriate fee. But they're not perfect either. They don't catch everything, but they help. They go a long way. So it's something we need to be looking at. Yeah, and I know the Faculty of Medicine is very interested in doing this at the faculty level. Yep. Thank you. Was that Martin? No, he's very helpful. Yes. Good subject liaisons, yes. What else can I answer?
Any
Certainly by policy, there's not an upper limit. I would expect that your agency would look at your grant budget with the same level of critical eye as they would ever look at your grant budget. You know, is this a good balance? Are they going to get 10 publications out of a one-year project and ask for $30,000 out of a $60,000 grant just for publication fees? Maybe that seems a little weird. I would assume it's totally dependent on the situation. But, you know, they always look at the grant budgets and say, wait, why are you spending money on that? And certainly where I come from in the U.S., they get back to you and they say, I'm not sure I buy this argument about why you're doing this. Can you adjust your budget accordingly? So I would expect that would happen. But, you know, on paper, they are allowable grant expenses. You should have no shame in putting them in.
I think in the life sciences, you could estimate, if you said the average is $3,000 typical operating grant, so you're in a job, I consider like 3 publications a year to fund it. So it would be reasonable to afford to ask for $9,000 if you have a strong online access budget.
Do program officers work on grant, budget development prior to submission here the way I'm used to? Yeah. So that's something you can ask before you submit as well. Does this look reasonable? Anything else? All right. Well, thank you. I think there's been really good questions today. They've helped me. I'm definitely going to take the PubMed Central issue back and see what we can do about that. And feel free to contact me or the eScholarship email anytime you like. Thank you.
Grant with the unless it's CHR. Are you in health sciences?
No, I'm
not. Okay, all right. So if there's for sure anything that the start date of the grant is May 1st or later, mm-hmm. the policy applies.
Okay.
If the start date was before that, it's confusing. If you're applying for a SHRC program, it's just about
mm-hmm.
like the whole program,
yeah,
the whole grant is just about the first off. It doesn't apply to all their work. It's only to the research.
No, it's the whole thing. They gave us the link. So in a little while, it's going to be available online on that same link.
Let me grab my laptop and we'll look up. Well, you can look that server on the air. You can look up publishers in addition to pilots.
Oh, I see.
So you can see what they, you can go there and you can look up their default policies and see whether it's green or blue.
Okay.
Good luck.
Well, thank you.
It went good.
Yeah.
Good questions.
Yeah.
All right. I think I know what you mean.
Cancel.
Just outside.
Okay.